It's Monday, the 22nd of November, and in this episode, we're going to talk about net neutrality and critique the Linux Journal Awards. We will, of course, cover the latest news, events, bits about Ubuntu, command line love, go over your feedback. I'm Laura, with me this week are Tony. Hail, Tony.
Hello, Laura.
What have you been doing this week?
I went to the theatre, don't you know? Actually, thanks to one of our guest presenters here this evening, who we'll introduce in a minute. He organised a trip to the theatre to see Colin Baker in Inspector Morse.
Yes.
It was very good.
It was.
A very good set. A very good theatre. Mm-hmm. It was very good. That's all I have to say.
And Mark?
Hello.
What have you been doing?
I bothered Spotify about Oxport and got quite a lengthy email from one of their tech support people about, well, not about much. I think I sort of, I emailed them asking why you can't play local OGG files even though they're streaming OGG. And I got an email saying, we have no plan to support OGG, blah, 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 blah. And that was it. And so I emailed back saying, well, hold on, I'm paying for this. I think I deserve a bit of a better reply. Ooh. And got a properly non-top posted going through each point of my email and replying to it specifically.
You mean the angry developer reply?
Well, it sounded like an angry developer, but also perhaps like a developer who sort of agreed with me.
Oh.
It was sort of, it was hard to tell. It's always hard to tell in emails, isn't it? The tone of someone's voice. But
it is in fact nearly impossible.
It is in fact nearly impossible. But yeah, so I don't know. They basically said that, you know, they can't say that they have any plans, and even, you know, up until the day they released the mobile apps, they were saying they had no plans for mobile apps because that's their policy. But if the developers have said that OGG support is in development, which they have on various blogs, then it probably still is.
Right.
But they, you know, they wouldn't give me an official line because they're not allowed to, basically.
So were they sort of intimating you think it might come in the future, or?
Yeah, that, I mean, it sounds like it might come in the future, but again, they said they couldn't and wouldn't give a timeline for it. So I'm right. Just sort of hoping still.
Well, fair enough. Laura, what about you?
I installed Netbook Edition 10.10 on Mum and Dad's netbook because they'd had to have something fixed, so it was refreshed. So I did it from scratch.
How did that go?
It went really well, and I hadn't seen the UI before.
Right.
So it's quite interesting. So I had to play around, and my mum's been playing with it and tweeted the other day that she was installing various applications on it, and did anybody suggest anything good? So it sounds like everything's going okay. And this week, we don't have Alan or Simon here.
Okay.
So instead, we have guest presenter, Andy Piper.
Hello, Andy.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you? What do you do?
Who am I and what do I do? So I work for a big computer company. I blog about lots of different things, some of which is sometimes Linux.
Okay.
But also some other operating systems as well.
Oh, right, okay.
There are other operating systems?
You really are a perfect substitute for Alan.
I am. Alan and I guess, share a few characteristics. So I have a blog at andypiper.co.uk.
Okay.
If people want to find out what I do. I used to do lots of GNOME projects quite a few years ago. I used to do lots of kind of project management and coordination of some open source stuff.
Oh, right. What sort of things? Anything we use today?
What did we do? Anjuta, the development IDE I used to be quite involved in. GNOME Sword, which is now called Xiphos, which is Bible software.
Oh, right. Okay.
So quite a few things I used to be fairly heavily involved in. I don't do so much of that anymore. I guess I get involved in Ubuntu through Launchpad and raising bugs and offering feature suggestions.
Cool.
What else do I do? I also co-host a weekly show called Dog Ear Nation, which is a podcast which is listener-driven about technology and futures.
Okay, sorry, Laura.
There, I was just going to probably say what you were going to say, in that it's got quite a cool premise, hasn't it, for how you pick your topics?
I think so. So the way that particular podcast works is that we invite listeners to tag things for us or tweet us links to things they think we should talk about this week. So usually it's kind of, we've got a set of topics like kind of future technology, virtual worlds, ways of interacting with the internet, and we kind of talk about them every week. So cool. Yeah, it's listener driven. It's quite fun.
So where can they find that?
That's at dogearnation.com, D-O-G-E-A-R nation.com.
Very good. Okay. So, so thank you for coming along and sort of stepping into the breach, as it were. We've got, as Laura mentioned, no Simon this week. And back in September, Simon announced that he was going to be leaving the Ubuntu UK podcast at the end of this season. So he's only got a couple of episodes left because we're going to go up to Christmas with this season. So if you would like to sort of write in and wish him all the best with his future endeavours, then please email podcast ubuntu-uk.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number's on the website. It's all fine. He's written about it at waitingcloud.org, which is his blog. He's just going to go off and focus on other things, so we wish him all the best. But yeah, it'd be nice to have some nice words to say to him on his last show before he goes off. Is that all that's hot we need to talk about, Laura?
I think so.
Okay, let's get on with it.
UK Communications Minister Ed Vasey has said that ISPs should be allowed to favour traffic from certain content providers, flying in the face of net neutrality campaigns from bodies such as the BBC and Google. Labour MP and all-round good guy Tom Watson has tabled an early-day motion against Ed Vasey's comments, stating, among other concerns, that an end to open internet could stifle online innovation.
Yeah, quite an interesting development, I guess, on this front. There was a very good spoof advert for a cables provider that I saw on the net, which sort of had various websites divided up into packages that you could license, in the same way that if you've got Sky Now, you buy the sports package and you buy the entertainment package or whatever, all as bolt-ons. So it's like, here's your basic cable access, your cable internet access. And if you want to get access to this, you buy the buy the YouTube top-up or the whatever it is, and you subscribe to these extra packages to get decent connectivity to these sites.
And what's it like if you don't? Really slow?
Well, this was only a spoof advert.
Yeah, supposed to be the worst-case scenario.
Yeah.
But yeah, those things like, you had to buy a package if you wanted all the search engines, and if you wanted social networks, you had to buy another package. Otherwise, you just got, you had to do or find all the sites yourself and things like that.
But isn't that like going to be just as hard as web filtering in the office? Because, you have to try and work out which sites fall into that category, and as new ones come along, you have to keep continuously recategorizing things.
Yeah, but I suspect if there's enough money in it, then the big ISPs.
Yeah, I think the worry is more, I think, to do with like commercial partnerships, where say if your ISP was to have a partnership with a certain search engine, for example, then you might either not be able to access another competing search engine, or you might not be able to access it at the same speed or with limited data transfer.
Or
similarly, if that provider also provides content, for instance, Virgin, as well as providing internet connections, also provides cable TV. So they might prioritise their own cable TV traffic over other traffic which you might want to see, like BBC iPlayer, for example.
So I noticed that Tim Berners-Lee's written this story in the Scientific American, which is called Long Live the Internet, I think, which has just been reported on today. And he was commenting that as being one of the concerns that cable companies who are controlling people's internet connections would like potentially to sell or just restrict those users to seeing their entertainment content in particular rather than the broad swathe of everything online.
So this has been going on quite a while on and off, hasn't it? I mean, who proposed it first and how did it first come up?
That's a good question to throw out there. Yeah.
I mean, from what I've been reading, the idea of net neutrality has been around for, over a decade.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, since the very fundamental basis of the internet.
Well, I suppose it would be.
Any one server is limited by the hardware. It can not. There's no central body governing which sites are faster or slower than others.
Yeah.
And it kind of fundamentally changes that. But that said, different ISPs already shape traffic.
Yes.
At a protocol level, they'll make peer-to-peer stuff slower, or they make web stuff faster because that's what most people use. So there's already a little bit of that going on. People haven't really got up in arms about that. It's an annoyance for heavy torrenters or something, but that's about it, really.
I suppose so.
And I don't know whether anybody's actually proposing that they will block access.
No one's actually proposed that at this stage. It's just as soon as people start talking about this sort of thing, as soon as people start talking about a two-tier system, people think, well, it could very easily go to a three-tier system, to an eight-tier system. Yeah.
It gets worse than this, partly because I read it today, to the Tim Berners-Lee story, but this is also something which has been brought up by the likes of the Wired editor recently, and this whole idea of the death of the internet, the death of the web, I should say, where a lot of the platforms that are emerging, so you've got, for example, the iPhone and iPad, content providers are producing content specifically for those platforms, which are now only consumable through their apps, which are platform-specific apps, rather than being delivered
through using an open web service, that's right, which anything could connect to.
So an open technology, which, is exactly right, that's openly consumable by lots of different applications.
Like a web page would be.
Yeah.
So what are the downsides of doing that, then?
Well, the downsides are that you have to continuously create new applications for different platforms. So, you know, on mobile, you've already got Windows 7 phone, you've got Android, you've got the iPhone, you've got the Nokia operating system, Mego, and all these other things. So every one of these is a different platform. And if the content isn't provided in an open format like a web page with, you know, open standards behind it, and I know Google has made an effort with things like WebM and other technologies to make this stuff open.
Yeah.
But if you have to consume some of it, or it's optimized for a particular device in a particular format, then you're not taking advantage of the openness of the...
But isn't that a burden on the media distributor, if you like? If they choose to have a special app for all these different platforms and support them and develop them, then that's their overheads they're talking about. It doesn't inherently have a problem for the consumer, or does it?
But if they only develop it for, say, iPhone, because that's the most popular, or Android, but then nothing else gets in there. And it also is creating monopolies, isn't it?
Actually, it's also a problem for platforms like Ubuntu. Because when you start to look at the Ubuntu App Store, right, the
Software Center,
I beg your pardon. the concept of an App Store is so common now, everybody wants an App Store for their platform, their thing.
Yeah.
Right? So you've got the Software Center in Ubuntu. But of course, Linux itself is a broader church than just Ubuntu, as we know. So the more that you start to encourage people to think of it as one way of looking at of the operating system through Unity or some other way of looking at the desktop, then you may start to cut out other applications or other packaging formats. We've been very successful with Linux because, you know, you can still typically get your applications packaged as RPMs or devs or as tarballs, to get a bit geeky for a moment.
Yeah. But we were talking before about the Kindle, weren't we? We had a listener, I can't remember who it was off the top of my head, who was asking about using Kindle ebooks on Linux.
Wasn't that for the future Ask Alan segment? Ask Tony segment. No,
definitely wasn't that segment.
Coming next
doesn't
week.
Exist. His question was, you know, how can I read Kindle ebooks on Linux? Because apparently, and I didn't know this, but there's a Windows app and a Mac app for Kindle, so you can read Kindle ebooks.
And an Android app.
But there's a reason for that, and that's because with the way that the Kindle distribution platform works and the way that the Kindle is designed to work, it actually synchronizes where you are in the book through the Amazon cloud. So there is some purpose to it, to having an app to read your content on the desktop as well.
But the main thing is the DRM, I guess.
That's true.
And we've heard many, many times about, you know, DRM restricting people's rights and taking away their freedom to do what they want with their own content. But with the web, it's a slightly different model. It's the distributor's content. They can do what they like with it.
Yeah, but the thing that net neutrality brings up is it's not you're suddenly giving the people who provide the connection control over who gets the content, rather than giving people who provide the content control over who gets the content.
The only thing is, if the people who control the connection also control the content, that's the other problem.
Well, is it really a bad thing if a particular ISP says, oh, guess what, all the BBC iPlayer stuff is going to be nice and fast on this connection, you know, you can watch all the programs over iPlayer? Is that really a bad thing?
At the expense of what?
At the expense of less popular
Wikipedia
sites. Well, I mean, at the moment you could do kind of some kind of statistical analysis of where your customers go and prioritize those sites. In fact, doesn't NTL, Virgin as they are now, do that already? Doesn't it have caches and that effectively speed up the performance of various bits of the net for their customers?
I think quite a few ISPs have kind of caches in their networks, absolutely.
But if they do that drastically, then it's going to spiral up so that the more popular ones become more popular and the least popular or new ones or independent ones aren't going to get a look in.
But there'd still be a market for independent ISPs. So if anybody is really bothered about the idea of all services being equal, then they could just go for
independent content. Yeah, and what if the only way that an ISP can set up is by renting the network off of a bigger provider who, at their level, shape the traffic and control the content.
And in the UK, we only got different telephone providers because BT were forced to.
Yeah.
Because they controlled everything. So if we got ISPs, big ISPs controlling everything, and without somebody legislating that they had to give up, they could not do.
Well, there's another, I mean, we're talking a little bit, and obviously this is because it's our own background and our own experience about the UK here, but and obviously it's a UK podcast, but there's a big threat in the US as well around the deal that Google proposed with Verizon around net neutrality, where they then wanted to exclude wireless connections from the deal they had around our openness of access to content. Well, that conveniently deals with Verizon customers. So.
I just had a message in the IRC channel, #ubuntu-uk-podcast on the Freenode IRC network, from Mike Basinger, who says, this is a little bit of a tangent, but he says there's a browser-based web app coming for the Kindle, which would maybe solve that our listeners' quandary that he was talking about before.
Dealing with DRM?
Well, presumably, if it's web-based, I mean, I don't know how it's going to work, but, you know, there we
go. If it's all in their cloud, I guess, if they put something on top of the page or something to stop you cutting. I mean, how easy is it going to be to cut and paste an entire book into a
text file?
Text file.
Go to the Gutenberg project and find out. One of the other things that Tim was talking about in net neutrality was he said that Facebook was a threat to the universality of the World Wide Web. It's easy for him to say.
Laura. I was going to say, I guess the threat is that Facebook's almost becoming this walled garden where they're trying to provide.
It's not becoming a walled garden. It is a walled garden.
No, it's just that it's extending its walls around everything else. Extending the walls. That's the problem.
Well, it's becoming very popular as well.
But in the past it was just somewhere that you went to play Mafia Wars and exchange messages with your friends.
People.
But the idea, they're extending all the services so you can do IM chat. Oh, well, you don't need to use MSN and AOL or anything anymore. So now you can, what's the new one that they're bringing in?
Well, they're doing Facebook Mail, which is some sort of combination of email and messaging.
The one I've seen Tim Berners-Lee talk about with the most concern is Facebook Connect, where instead of logging in to a website, you log in with your Facebook account, like with OpenID, which means if you don't have a Facebook account, you then perhaps can't access certain websites.
I think a lot of websites continue to offer both OpenID and Twitter and Facebook Connect, but you're right that OpenID as an idea seems to have fallen by the wayside as Twitter and Facebook both become more popular and most people have those rather than having to go and set up an OpenID and then remember the URL of that OpenID. The big problem with that, and he also comments on LinkedIn and other sites, is that they're sucking in data and they don't easily let you export data. And it's actually something we talked about on my own podcast a couple of weeks ago. Google then had a little page where if you try to import your Google contacts into Facebook, Google now throws up a page saying, are you really sure you want to put this data into a site which won't let you get it back out again?
That's interesting.
Wow. Oh.
Have you not come across that?
I don't put a lot of stuff into Facebook, to be honest, for that very reason.
So Facebook's now banned from accessing the Gmail contents.
Oh, yeah, no, I did hear that.
And there's actually a page that you'll get if you go onto Google.
It's quite interesting because, I mean, Google has a lot of brickbats thrown at it for doing that sort of thing, for being a big corporation and... But it's always worked hard, in my view, to try and enable people to move away from their services. You know, you get full IMAP access to Google Mail and you could just click and drag it onto any other IMAP server.
I think Google just have more charm as well. Somehow they get away with stuff that Facebook doesn't.
Yeah. There's always the risk of any third-party authentication sort of federation service being dependent on a thing anyway.
An entity,
whatever it is. I mean, you could argue that MSN Hotmail messaging has been that for years. It's the most popular thing, and because most people use it,
in the same way that IE was the standard web, pages, your web standards in sort of, well, before Firefox came along, was a page that worked on IE basically.
Well, yes and no, but I mean there were standards before IE,
but they weren't de facto standards.
No, MSN is effectively invented IM. I'm ignoring IRC, you know, and
ICQ
and Wall.
Wall?
Right, where you on the Unix command?
Nope.
Right. I know what you mean, Tony. Don't you worry.
Thanks, Andy. So ignoring it, it is the first major success.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
And it was a closed protocol, and you either in it or you weren't. And if you've got friends who are in it, you know, you had to have an MSN. You still do have to have an MSN type account.
Yeah.
You can now enable your own email address, which is a slightly different approach. It gives you a little more degree of freedom. But, you know, you're still relying on their closed Proscore servers. If they were to shut it down tomorrow, nothing can work.
So I think aside from, like, the philosophical reasons why you shouldn't, Facebook just makes it easy to happen. Like, I log into Daily Mail with Facebook just because it's easier and it posts directly. It knows that.
There's a big button that says connect in.
Yeah, and I have the option not to, but it's easier too. And then I know people who use Facebook for messaging instead of email, and they have done for ages, just because it's easier just to type someone's name in than it is to type an email address in. And you typically only email people that you know anyway.
One of the things that Tim Berners-Lee is worried about, apparently, is the idea that if a single social networking site becomes a monopoly, and fair enough, you've got to argue Facebook already is. Sorry, I just got bitten by a cat. a friendly kind of nibble, but I wasn't expecting it. Is that if one social networking site becomes a monopoly, it tends to limit innovation. And he sort of says, you know, people should consider things like Diaspora or GNU Social, which I've not heard of.
No, I haven't either. There's another, he talks about GNU Social and also talks about Identica, doesn't he? Or the...
The status.net.
Status.net, yeah, that's right.
Which is interesting, but we discussed before the problems that we have with kind of Facebook-alike clones, or not clones, but, you know, Facebook-like equivalents.
Yeah.
And whether they actually have enough momentum to kind of build up a consistent user base and maintain that user base and be a useful thing that people want to participate in. I still have loads more followers on Twitter than I do on Identica.
Yeah, exactly. I don't really use my Identica account because all of my friends are on Twitter.
Yeah, and I know like 4 or 5 people on Facebook, you know, so it's really cool.
That's
really
all. Popular.
Yeah, that's it. No, I mean, yeah, there are 500 million people on Facebook worldwide.
Yeah.
And it's already got there. I mean, it's a monopoly already. I don't think there's much we can do to complain other than just ask them nicely to do so.
It's a monopoly in terms of social networking sites. It's not yet a monopoly over everything email and IM related, but it could be, and it's going away. That way.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think one thing, maybe somebody needs to come up with a better system. Now, maybe Google Wave was trying to do this, just being able to use messaging without having to have email addresses and little things like that, people really like about Facebook.
Yeah.
But you do have to have an email address to log into Facebook in the first place, of course, and it doesn't have to be a Facebook one. So anyway.
Yes, that's true.
Well, in order to wrap up, it's probably just worth mentioning that Ed Vasey, the minister that Mark referenced in the opening of the segment, has allegedly backtracked a little bit on the interpretation of his comments about net neutrality, saying that actually, although the government's choosing not to regulate it, it would step in if it felt, you know, things were getting out of hand. So, make of that what you will.
It's nicely on the fence.
Yeah, but, you know, there we go.
And now it's time for the news. Linux kernel hacker Mike Galbraith has written a patch to increase interactivity of desktop applications while the system is under load. This has sparked discussion amongst distribution teams about the best way to implement the patch, which is likely to be included in the stable kernel release 2.6.38, according to a member of the Ubuntu kernel team, which I think would come out in about 6 months-ish.
Yes, this is a really interesting little patch. I mean, obviously not being a developer, I don't quite understand it, but the
but you're going to talk about it anyway.
Absolutely, that's what journalism is about. I have seen the videos that he's produced, which is what I was really going to say, online, and they're really quite cool. He's done a before and after with this patch on it, and the responsiveness of his desktop, even under load, making like a 64-threaded kernel compile happen or something, is great. And then Windows update pretty much, and it all moves around.
Does it reprioritize?
I think that's what it does, yeah.
Yeah.
By TTY, so because your GUI runs under TTY7, then it gives your stuff running on that priority over stuff you're running in other virtual terminals, I think.
Well, there you go. That's why you're here, to add that insight.
And a caveat at the end.
Paul Chambers, a Twitter user who was convicted of menacing behaviour after publishing a tweet in which he mentions blowing up Robin Hood Robin Hood Airport has lost his appeal. The news prompted a large number of Twitter users to post a verbatim copy of his tweet as a show of solidarity, while Stephen Fry offered to pay the fine and legal costs amounting to £3,000.
Today they announced that he was going to be taking the case to the High Court as well, I think. I noticed as well that lots of my Twitter, the people I follow on Twitter, have got maybe a joke overlaid on their avatar, pointing with an arrow pointing.
Oh, I've got all that. I'm following the guy who started it.
Ah, very good. I haven't found the site which lets me do that yet.
But Twibbon.com.
Oh, it's a Twibbon one, is it?
Yes.
Okay. Very good.
And it points to what you're saying, not to
yeah,
you.
Point, yeah, yes. No, it's right, okay. In the corner of your avatar, points to your tweet, assuming that your avatar is on the left of your tweet, which is in most clients.
Ah.
I did see a retweet of somebody saying that it was insulting their music collection.
Is it the
it's
Twitter?
Maybe a joke.
The Twitter... The Twitter equivalent of I'm with stupid.
Yes, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
Following on from the recent announcement that Apple's implementation of Java for Mac OS X is deprecated, Apple has announced that it will be working with Oracle to ensure an OS X implementation of Java SE 7 is available through the OpenJDK project.
Right. So, Java on Apple is dead. Oh, no, it's not.
Don't live Java on Apple. Yeah.
And Oracle is the saviour.
What went wrong
well,
there?
Well, not quite. They just said... Open everything's going to be living in OpenJDK, and actually, if you, as I understand the situation, some of the rules that they're putting down around contribution to OpenJDK may not be quite as nice as you might have hoped.
And isn't the licensing around OpenJDK sort of free, but not really as free as we'd like it to be free?
I think that's a fair comment.
Probably as free as Oracle would like it to be, I guess.
Yes, absolutely.
Jolly Cloud, the producer of the web-focused operating system of the same name, has announced its first netbook, dubbed the Jolly Book. Blimey. The machine comes pre-installed with the Jolly Cloud operating system and features the new generation of dual-core Intel Atom processors. And it's not quite available in the UK yet, is that right?
I think it's listed on Amazon, but they are showing a lead time of 1 to 3 months, so that could mean it might turn up any time between now and my birthday, pretty much.
Right.
Sometime. In the first quarter of next year.
Okay, if anybody wants to get you a present.
Exactly. It's got a very nice, colourful lid.
Yeah, it does. It looks quite a nice design.
Quite pretty.
It is the lid that I always look for first.
Yeah. I am tempted. I've played with Jolly Cloud, the operating system, on my Acer Aspire 1, and it's quite a nice operating system, assuming you want everything as web apps, basically, which is very similar to what Google Chrome OS is going to be, so we understand. And I think they say that it bundles Chromium, which is the open source version of Google Chrome.
Yeah.
So I'd be quite tempted to have one.
How much are they retailing at?
I think it's £279 in the UK, which is
cheap.
It's not cheap, but it's actually a reasonable price compared to, I think, other netbooks of a similar spec.
Okay.
It does have a hard disk. It's not a solid state drive.
Right.
I'm fairly sure it's a fairly sizable disk.
System 76, the Colorado-based company who ships computers pre-installed with Ubuntu, has announced that it plans to begin shipping to the UK.
Hooray.
While initial models will ship with US keyboards and power supplies, the company say they will be providing 3-pin adapters to UK customers. I don't know what you're on about, Tony. You've already got one.
I've already got one, and it's a US one.
And how do you find it?
It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. It really isn't. I shan't complain because it was a presentation to me, so I really enjoy it and appreciate it. I have kind of just about got the US UK keyboard maps in my brain, so I can switch between them fairly easily.
Do you not just jimmy the keys off and switch into the right places?
I did suggest that.
It didn't work. But yeah, it's very nice, and they do pretty nice hardware, and obviously Ubuntu installed, and there's a little Ubuntu key
as well. Ah, that's nice.
Windows key. So yeah. As long as they do UK keyboards, I'll be quite happy.
A project for helping geeks provide technical support to their friends and family has been launched. The project, named GeekShare, is aimed at enabling geeks to swap technological dependence with others to prevent tensions that may occur when helping those close to you.
This sounds like a brilliant idea.
Brilliant.
But this isn't a very geeky podcast, is it? I thought this was a podcast for normal users.
Yeah, that's right.
But even normal users have their
parents
or dependents.
That's why I gave my mother a laptop with Windows 7 on it.
Get out.
Okay. I sense the mood has just changed in this recording studio.
Yes, but so, I kind of like this idea. This is fantastic. So you could, if you are supporting your parents, you support your parents, Laura, don't you?
No, they support themselves.
Okay, but you've helped.
You support your parents.
Yeah, so I could swap them with somebody else.
You can swap.
Is that
it's
how it
a
works?
Parent swap site.
Okay.
The premise is that people frequently get very frustrated with their own parents when they're trying to provide tech support, as opposed to other people's parents who they're perfectly polite to.
Right.
So if you get frustrated with your parents, you can swap them for somebody else's parents and help them instead.
But I can't swap them for like an old Shawaddy Waddy poster and a Bucks Fizz album or something.
I don't know.
No, okay.
I'm sure Popey can help you with that. The Free Software Foundation Latin America has announced that the Linux Libre project that aims to create a Linux distribution with all non-free code removed from the kernel. The FSF Latin America claim that the current Linux kernel contains software that does not respect your essential freedoms and that it induces you to install additional non-free software that it doesn't contain.
Interesting.
I like their use of the word induces there. It's if you read the announcement on their site, it basically sort of, it seems to say that Linus Torvalds wants you to install non-free software and Linux is his way of getting you to do it. It's a bit, right. a bit strongly worded.
Are we sure there's not a lost in translation thing going on?
There could be.
Right, okay.
But I mean, it says the Linux kernel made by Linus Torvalds contains non-free software and induces you to install more.
But this is the same thing that Debian's been trying to do for years, which is get rid of the vague...
It's the same thing Stuart Langridge has been trying to do for years.
Yeah,
hi, Stuart. Sure.
But, I mean, it is. It's getting rid of the... It's clearing up bits of the kernel that aren't licensed properly. Remember, there was a thing that Sun released just after they got bought. They clarified the licensing on a whole stack of code. It's removing binary blobs and firmware and stuff that were in there. It's fair enough, isn't it? I mean, I can't see that there's...
Well, apparently, from what I've heard, at the moment, it is basically just a shell script that goes through the kernel tree and pulls things out. So I certainly wouldn't trust it on a server.
I have to say, I'm just looking at the announcement, the actual page on the Linux Libre website, and it's got a particularly cute picture of a penguin pegged up onto a washing line and
hung out to dry, perhaps.
Sad.
Laura and I both sat here kind of thinking,
Aww. Oh, bless. Evidence has been found to suggest that the Stuxnet virus discovered in Iran in June was specifically written to target systems used for enriching uranium. The Windows virus was apparently designed to subtly change the behaviour of motors in centrifuge equipment to sabotage the process over a long period of time.
I thought I heard this was actually, and this is rumour, this is total speculation, I thought I read somewhere that this actually was targeting something called the SCADA protocol, which is an industrial automation system, but I need to go and read the news stories again.
It was to do with I think the automation systems behind things like the centrifuges and stuff.
And it was if there were a certain amount of certain types of devices being controlled by them from certain companies, some of which are from Iran and some of which are from Finland, and depending on the proportion of the different companies that made them depended on what it did.
Yeah.
And it was all very...
It's quite specific.
Yeah,
quite
very targeted. Specific and quite scary.
Bearing in mind that probably not many countries outside Iran are using Iranian nuclear equipment.
No.
The idea that it was focusing on equipment specifically manufactured or that was identifying itself as specifically manufactured in Iran, and it was introducing kind of just errors.
Yeah.
It's like it was changing the speed of things.
Yeah, it wasn't sort of making it break, but it was messing up the process.
So
isn't that bad for everybody else as well, though?
What, if they have dodgy nuclear equipment? Yeah, potentially. I think my interpretation, or at least the interpretation of some people who've written articles about this, is that it was designed to sort of disrupt their testing process and slow down the development of the systems rather than blow everything up.
That's
because at the end of the day, they've got planes which can blow things up if they wanted to flatten it.
I think I'll keep running my uranium enrichment programs on Linux.
Yeah, I think I would do that too. Is that why you're glowing in green?
Thomas Roth, a German programmer, has posted details of how to use Amazon EC2's new cluster GPU instances to perform password cracking. Using brute force techniques to reverse engineer SHA-1 hashes, Roth demonstrated how he cracked a series of 1-6 character passwords using only $2 worth of time on Amazon's cloud.
Yes, this is an interesting new way of distributing processing in a perhaps less than constructive way.
Yes. Or, well, I think the tone of his blog post was to highlight that you shouldn't use SHA-1 anymore, much in the same way that Firesheep's point was to say that people should use HTTPS more, I suppose.
Well, also, I mean, the fact that GPUs can do particularly high-speed
floating point algorithms. Yeah, that was his other reason for doing this, now that you can get GPU instances on EC2.
So it's value for money.
Yeah, basically.
So what should we be using these days? I mean, a lot of people are still using MD5, and we know we shouldn't use that. We use SHA-1 sums, checksums on the podcast. It's fine.
Oh no, they might reverse engineer it and get the data for the show from it.
Yeah.
But might get our voice prints and use them to shut down uranium reactors.
Well, there are successors in the SHA family, which I suppose must be more uncrackable.
Or just for now.
I mean, in a long enough timescale, I suppose anything's crackable if you've got enough GPU instances on Amazon's cloud and enough money to buy them.
Well, that's it. The cloud is what's making it very scalable and distributed. Whereas before, you'd have to have run your own server to get this amount of distribution.
Novell, who sponsor OpenSUSE, as well as a number of related open source projects, have today announced that they have agreed to be acquired by Attachmate Corporation. Attachmate Corporation has said that it will run Novell and SUSE as two separate business units, while certain areas of Novell's intellectual property assets will be sold to Microsoft-owned CPTN Holdings LLC. CNET reports that an SEC filing indicates that this includes 882 patents.
Oh, that's fine, then.
Yeah.
So that's no problem. I don't be worried.
So 800 odd patents going to essentially Microsoft.
Basically.
And what does this mean for the SCO ongoing debacle?
Is that still going?
I was gonna say, is it still ongoing?
Well, SCO keeps saying they're going to come back, don't they? But Novell were the people who said we have the copyright for Unix, and it stood up in court, and therefore SCO didn't have a case. But, you know, now this new company is effectively going to have the copyrights for Unix. And will they defend the case? Because the original SCO case, Novell wasn't involved in, and they sort of came along and said, look, we have the copyrights, and obviously spent money doing that, which they didn't have to do, and we don't know whether the new company would be as vociferous, perhaps, in defending that.
So who are Attachmate Corporation? I mean, what do they do already?
They make sort of software for Unix systems, like IBM-type systems. They make terminal emulators and some security software and things like that.
Does it say something that a company that was once as big and prosperous as Novell and SUSE and Zimian, who got bought into Novell as well, has now got bought by a company that nobody and who makes terminal emulators?
I was reading somewhere that Attachmate's several years younger than Novell. I think Novell was founded in 76, which is about four years before Attachmate or something like that.
So Attachmate has been around for
they've been around a long time, for sure. Yeah. 30 years, it's claimed on their website.
They've obviously got plenty of money.
Yeah, well, those terminal emulators go like hotcakes, don't they? Couple of events to mention, and the Barcamp Southampton is coming up on this Saturday, so that's the 27th, I want to say.
Sounds about right.
At me. Yeah,
sounds about okay. Right.
This Saturday, anyway, there might still be some tickets, and come along if you can get one.
And you can meet some of the podcast
hosts. We're going.
Oh, yeah, Mark, we're going to be there. Yeah.
Andy, are you going?
I'm going to be there.
Excellent.
Are you going, Mark?
Yes.
Brill.
Laura's going. I'm going. I can't remember if any of the others are going.
They're not here, so.
They don't get to say it. Fair enough.
And the Ubuntu UK local Christmas party is on Tuesday the 21st of December, and it's at the Hub Islington in London.
Yeah, from 7 o'clock in the evening till 10 o'clock. And there's a lovely picture on the announcement that I saw of mince pies with the Ubuntu logo on top. And that just made me want to eat lots of mince pies.
I nearly got mince pies tonight.
Looking forward to our Christmas episode. But yeah, check that out, and I'm sure there'll be some people along there.
I noticed that, having said that, Tony, you're not listed on the list of attendees.
I am off work that week, so I may go. I haven't decided yet.
Keep on guessing.
It's time for some command line love, and we've got a special command this time, which we'll put on the show notes, as always, which we won't read out. But it gives you stats about how long programs have been running on Linux. Have you had a look at it, Mark?
Briefly. So it's sort of like uptime, but instead of for your whole system, for individual sort of processes.
Yeah, it gives you the amount of CPU time, basically. I think. It shows you when they were started on the system. If a process has crashed and restarted or something like that, you can see what time the program was started on your system, as in 0925 or whatever. It shows you the process ID, and it shows you the full command that was used to start that process as well. So if you have processes that are mysteriously dying or restarting or something like that, then you can use that to check it out. It uses the PS command that you may or may not be familiar with. And that's your command line love.
Okay, so at the end of last month, Linux Journal published the results of its Reader's Choice Awards 2010. So we're going to go through the winners and discuss what we think.
Yes, there's a range of categories, and they get quite detailed at the end. Probably won't go through every single
thing. Yeah, some of them are a bit specific.
Slightly random, isn't it?
It's possibly worth noting that they had over 12,000 people vote and participate in the awards.
Wow.
Which is pretty impressive. I mean, Linux Journal, I don't think, is particularly well-known so much in the UK because it's primarily a US publication.
Mm-hmm.
I used to subscribe back in the day, but I haven't taken the paper copy of the magazine for a few years.
But 12,000 is quite an interestingly large number. It certainly gives us perhaps an idea.
Yeah, you don't usually see, sort of online, you don't see surveys with that sort of participation around Linux anyway.
Exactly. So it perhaps gives us a reasonably good idea of what might be going on there in the big wide world.
And of course, we're very upset by the Linux distribution that won.
Yeah, it's an outrage.
And definitely not why we're talking about this story.
No, of course not. So Ubuntu apparently won, which is great. Best Yay. Linux distribution, with Debian coming in third, Fedora in fourth. Perhaps not a great surprise. Okay, yes, cue lots of angry emails from Fedora users. But, you know, Ubuntu basically continues to have a big groundswell of popularity and support across the Linux distribution field, yeah. Which is great.
And not just on the desktop.
Yes, that's right, because the netbook, I want to say netbook remix, netbook edition,
yes.
Got another award. What was that award?
That was for the best distribution for netbook / limited hardware, which I assume means tablets as well.
To be fair, it says it's the Ubuntu netbook remix, which is the one that we normally associate with
right.
10.04, isn't it?
So
or 9.10,
before,
I can't remember.
Before Unity.
Oh, right.
It's before UNE, which is the edition.
Oh, yes, no,
it's,
sorry, I see what you mean by, yeah, the older yes. version.
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
And that's the screenshot.
And that's the screenshot that it's showing in the associated story. So actually, that's the one that I'm running on my Acer at the moment. I haven't gone to 10.10, mainly because I don't particularly want to go to Unity on there because I've read things about its performance.
I'm running 10.10 with the old interface.
That's okay. That's interesting. So I have installed Unity, actually, on my Acer Aspire Revo, which I think is the same box that Alan uses as well as a kind of a, and you've got one as well, have you?
Yeah.
As a TV box.
Oh,
now, the interesting thing I found, and this is one of the bits of feedback I was going to phone into the podcast a couple of weeks ago.
But now you're here in person.
I'm here, right here. Look at me. I'm speaking into your own microphone.
So we don't have any choice.
Exactly. So, yeah, I find the interesting thing with Unity is actually it works pretty well on a big screen. From, you know, if you're sitting on the other side of a room, I tend to use my Revo as a boxy box. But if I want to go out to the desktop, then actually the Ubuntu or the GNOME desktop's a bit fiddly. So having kind of big icons and then full screen stuff or most of the screen stuff actually works reasonably well. So I'm looking forward to seeing it when its comp is accelerated. I think that will work well.
Yes, and in fact, it's my Revo that's running our big clock that you can see on the screen here.
It's a lovely big clock,
it
Tony.
It's massive. One of the interesting things
it's
about
big and
the
green.
It is, yeah. One of the interesting things, the runner up on that was Google Android. It's quite a wide ranging category. It says netbooks and limited hardware, but it's got like Puppy and Google Android and.
Well, limited hardware. I mean, I think Android is actually aimed for quite substantial hardware. I mean, smartphones these days are really quite decent.
Giga plus processors and stuff.
Exactly. Well, actually, and this is another thing I can talk about since I'm here and
I
have you as a captive audience temporarily. So I've recently picked up my foray into Android phones.
Oh,
so
yes.
I'm an iPhone user, I'm afraid, but I have
really
now got an Android
Alan,
phone as well.
You?
Yes, exactly. I'm trying to make everybody forget. No, that's not true.
And Android,
so I've
of course, won the best mobile OS.
I picked up Android as an Android phone for development, really, because I, you know, as we know, the iPhone is not an easy phone to develop for, whereas Android is quite nice. So I've got a what's called an Orange San Francisco, which is a rebadged ZTE Blade. They're quite it's a low end Android device.
Yeah.
It's only got a 600 megahertz processor, but I've just upgraded to Android 2.2 on it, and it works really nicely.
I was really impressed. I mean, you said you paid sort of less than 100 quid for it. And, you know, for a phone like that, that's pretty good.
A touch screen. It's a beautiful screen. It's not got the best camera in the world, but I didn't buy it to use as a camera. I've got an iPhone, which I'm happy with, and a compact camera. Yes, it's very nice.
Okay, and the this is a good one. Best desktop environment.
Is such a cop out.
Why is that, Laura? Is it because one of those two is actually the best one?
No, yeah, KDE.
Because they've just said GNOME and KDE. I mean,
right?
Maybe the votes were genuinely tied.
Maybe, but it seems a bit like they've just gone, oh, we just don't want it. Don't want to push it.
Yeah, maybe it's the interest, the era of coalitions, you know, KDE and GNOME coalition, unlikely bedfellows, but, you know, who knows, they might make it work.
That's okay, because Canonical will just ignore it anyway and build their own desktop.
Ooh. Quite interestingly, in the little rise up for this bit, they haven't put any stats in about, you know, what percentage. Hang on. Something like KDE had sort of 7% over GNOME. But
no, I think it's saying that KDE gained on GNOME by 7%.
Oh, right. Okay. So clearly KDE is still behind GNOME, but yeah, it's a tie. Yeah. Okay.
Something.
Nice to see XFCE, LXDE, and Fluxbox in the other places. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, every desktop environment currently going apart from Window Maker. So, you know, pretty much turn up, you get a prize on this occasion.
Oh, no mention of Enlightenment.
Oh, yeah, no mention of Enlightenment. Yeah, fair enough. Or Unity. Next category?
Best web browser.
Okay.
I think this is getting a bit controversial as well now.
Yeah.
Well, what's the result?
Firefox won, and Chrome was the runner-up.
But, I mean, Seriously, we all know that Opera's the best one, so I don't know quite why it came in third.
They only came in third.
So, all right, looking around, there's four of us in the studio. Who's running which web browser?
I'm currently running Chromium.
I run Firefox.
I run Chrome.
I run Chrome.
Oh. Ooh.
Well, there we go. I think we've... decided which one, just on the basis of that straw poll of four people in the room, rather than 12,000 people who voted.
So it's quite interesting. It says Chrome leapt from a barely perceptible 0.35% of the vote in 2009 to 24% this year.
Similar to its market share,
quite
in fact.
Quite a grow, yeah.
That's fair enough. That's really good.
But yeah, I've still not... I used Chrome for a bit, but I still went back to Firefox. Mainly, I don't know. I mean, I do a lot of development. And I like Firebug a lot.
Chrome is on version 9 in experimental now. So they are turning over versions of Chrome at a remarkable speed.
Anyone can raise a number.
Well, that's true. But they are, you know, significantly upping the feature set each time. Now, admittedly, they're still kind of, in some spaces, coming to parity with other browsers. But I think if you look at Chrome and its support for standards, we've talked about them already in this in this show.
Yeah.
They are really pushing things forward, and I'm really impressed.
Perhaps I'll give it another look then.
One of the interesting things for me is that they haven't restricted themselves in terms of the journal. Sorry, I'll say the Linux journal. They haven't restricted themselves in terms of the packages they're using. I mean, Opera is not open source on Linux, and later on they're talking about web services and things. So it isn't just that they've stuck to the open source software you can get on Linux, the best of breed. It's whatever you can get on Linux by the look of it. Or maybe people could just write in what they wanted to.
Yeah, whatever Linux journal users use on Linux.
Yeah, exactly. So best email client was the next one. Any bets?
Lotus Notes.
Didn't make the cut on this occasion.
Outlook?
Again, that might just been bubbling under, maybe just under sixth place there.
Outlook Express.
Right, now you're just being silly.
I used to use the email client that's currently in fifth place, which is Mutt.
Oh, right, okay, so console-based email.
And in fact, before that, I used Pine.
I used Pine a bit if I'm using my plug server remotely.
I used it in the past.
I might be using Cone, now that you mention it. I can't remember.
Cone, I didn't hear of that one.
Oh.
I can see where that name came from, though.
Yeah.
I used to use Elm at university.
Oh. Yeah, well, the winner, bringing us back to the point, was Thunderbird.
So is this the Linux Journal Awards from 1988?
Yeah. Yeah, I use Thunderbird.
Thunderbird, okay.
Don't like it a lot, but it's...
I used it, and then I used Kmail, and then I used Thunderbird again, and now I've stuck with Kmail.
Thank goodness for IMAP, which allows you to flip between email clients. One of the interesting things I was going to say about this is that we don't know which version of Thunderbird it is. Two or three. I mean, I found three to be a lot more resource-intensive than two, and a bit slower and stuff as a result. But the runner-up was Gmail, the Google's email web client thing.
Yeah, so, which is, that's an interesting runner-up to have, really.
It is an email client, of course, but it basically works the same on any browser or on any platform.
Can you put your IMAP into that?
So what, read an IMAP account from Gmail? I don't know.
I don't think so. You can definitely do Pop3. I aggregate all of my accounts from Pop3 into Gmail. So my Gmail is my single source, and then I use IMAP from any device to talk to Gmail. It works really well for me. I'm happy with it. But then, of course, you have to live with the Google advertising and aggregation of all your data and so on. But we've gone through that today already as well. So.
Indeed. Okay. Next up, Mark.
Is best IM client.
Okay. And the winner is...
Pigeon.
I bet it's Empathy. Oh, no. Oh. Empathy's only in fourth place.
Oh,
I didn't know AMSN, which is fifth, was still going.
Okay.
AMSN... I thought that became something else.
I thought it just stopped working. So AMSN is an MSN
lookalike, which I used to use.
Yeah,
so
I used
really
that
good.
For a bit. Yeah,
but I think actually the interesting one here again, given our focus on open source products, is our runner-up, which is Skype.
Yeah.
Now Skype, I find Skype very interesting, and I'll tell you why.
Because
I'm really
going
to get thrown out of the studio as soon as I say the next set of words. I have an Xbox.
Ooh. Okay, that's fine.
I do have a Kinect.
So does Papu.
Oh, well, okay. Well, Alan and I obviously are, you know,
Because you're not both in the room at the same time, we can cope.
Yeah, okay.
But maybe they are the same person.
So anyway, the Kinect lets you do video Kinect, which is video chat on your TV. Now, the interesting thing about that is it will interoperate with Windows Live Messenger video and potentially with the new Windows phones. Now, I think that's a very interesting video chatting platform. But of course, the majority of people who want to do video chat online now are using Skype because it's so widely available on all platforms. Now, the interesting thing about the Linux version of Skype is that it's so far behind the Mac and Windows versions. I mean, it doesn't have group chats. It doesn't have all kinds of other features that exist in those other versions. And although they've made some efforts towards pretending or saying they're going to open things up. That hasn't yet borne a lot of fruit.
I'm really disillusioned now. I didn't know. I was missing so much.
Yeah.
I thought it was brilliant that it did video.
But the weird thing about this category is you see, like, Pigeon wins it and Capete and Empathy come third and fourth, and they're, like, really full-featured IM clients, which do multiple protocols, as many accounts as you want. Skype, you can do voice chat and video chat and Skype to other people with a Skype client. But that's about what you can do.
Well,
that came second.
What we were saying before, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And for me, Skype seems to have had a resurgence over the last 12 months where, I mean, it's been around for years. I signed up for it probably 4 or 5 years ago originally.
So my view on that is, as someone who's seen his mother get into Facebook and Skype and adopt a lot of this stuff because it's become so easy to use, and, you know, it's a good way of keeping in touch with grandchildren and all those kinds of things. I think that's why things like Skype have really taken off. I think as the internet has enabled, you know, these long distance communications much more easily, I think that things like Skype have really benefited.
So a consequence of there being more bandwidth in hotels.
Absolutely. And, exactly right. More bandwidth, easier to install, easier to get to use, and people just understanding it. You know, it's fairly commonplace now.
Busting up next was the best microblogging client. Of course, everybody's favourite. It's perfect. It never fails.
TweetDeck.
No, not on the list for some reason.
It's not even in second, third, fourth, or fifth. That's outrageous.
It is the Ubuntu default GWIBA. Now, Mark's little favourite, Chocock came in as a runner-up.
What about Hotot? Is nobody using Hotot?
Never heard of that.
No, it didn't win either.
No, it's also not on the list, but it's quite nice.
Rather confusingly, the screenshot, including GWIBA, to be frank, I thought it was a screenshot of my GWIBA client for a minute. Basically got pretty much everybody I follow. Ivanka from the Canonical Design team, John O'Bacon's on there, Stuart Language is
Bruno.
On there. Bruno's on there. It's basically a Lug Radio Ubuntu mashup going on, but it's not actually mine.
Kevin Smith.
And Kevin Smith, yeah, so all the people I follow. We probably haven't got time to go through the rest of them, only to mention the fact that the best backup tool, apparently, on Linux is rsync. So, you know...
It does the job.
It does do the job. Well,
the best cloud-based file storage is Dropbox and not Ubuntu 1.
Oh, there we go. But yeah, so if you want to check those out, we'll put a link in the show notes to the rest of the awards there. They all get a bit technical after that. But
I think it's a... you're right, we don't have time to go through them all, but I think it's a good thing to see... what tools are available, what tools you may not have played with, especially if you're using the default apps in Ubuntu already. There may be some alternatives that are worth looking at.
Yeah, indeed. And there's some nice credits further on down for the best hardware vendor and best Linux Journal column and stuff. So some people as well as just bits of software. So yeah, check that one out. Right, it's time for the bit about Ubuntu. He's not here. There's nobody here to say Gerald. It's brilliant. Okay.
You just said
Gerald.
It.
Oh. We did it.
So close, so near, but yet so far. Right, fair enough. The first item in the bit about Ubuntu this time is from Mark.
Am Grainer is stepping down from the Ubuntu news team and has put the call out for a replacement and contributors.
Yeah, I mean, Amber does a huge amount of work for Ubuntu news. I mean, it's a massive, great thing, and it comes out weekly. And she's asking for more volunteers and things as well. So I guess it's probably partly a workload issue that's going on there. But obviously she's saying that during the transition period there will be delays in producing the newsletter for a few weeks and things. So
this is a separate project to, was it the Ubuntu Fridge, now called something else?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Ubuntu Weekly News is a big kind of basically a text-based thing that can be
thing,
a web, it's a wiki page and it gets published and it goes around as emails,
right,
and things like that. So it links very often to our show when we have a new episode out. And it's been going ever since, basically almost ever since Ubuntu came out, 200 issues, over 200 issues now. And Amber's been in charge of them most recently, I think for the last year or so. Sorry, Amber, if I got that wrong. It's obviously a lot of hard work, and I guess she's looking for somebody to take over, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well done. Thank you for all your hard work, Amber. And if you're interested in taking over, we'll put a link in the show notes and you can maybe find out how to get involved.
Didier Roche posted to the Ubuntu developer mailing list that there will unfortunately be no Unity compers backported to Ubuntu 10.10.
Why is that a bad thing?
Well, because it means that I'm not going to upgrade my netbook from 10.04 to 10.10 because I'd quite like a Unity accelerated or compers effect enabled version of Unity, and I'm not going to use it without it.
But bear in mind that even if they had it, it would probably only be a sort of development preview, not very stable, just to try it out so you get used to it.
Yeah, that's true. And to be honest, I'm, you know, at the moment with that particular netbook, I'm happy to wait. Mm. Never a stranger to controversy, Jono Bacon has kicked off his Open Respect project under a cloud which appears to be clearing slowly.
Yeah, Jono came up with the idea of a project called Open Respect, which basically was a statement of respect, good behaviour between open source projects and people and companies and things. It came out of some perceived criticism of Canonical for some of their decisions they made, but John is very clear that this is a separate project, not a Canonical slash Ubuntu project.
His project?
Yeah, it's a personal project, and he's tried to get people from other projects involved and some endorsements and things from people. There was a bit of a hoo-ha at the beginning because some people had been tipped off about the project by Jono, but then they felt they weren't given enough opportunity to input before it all went live. But things have sort of settled down a bit now. Everybody's kind of having some respect for each other, ironically. But the Open Respect is a sort of a statement of how you can have constructive debate and criticism without it turning sort of nasty and knee-jerky, I think.
I did notice a lot of it seems to be similar to the sort of stuff that's in the book, actually, The Art of Community.
Oh, right, okay.
In terms of, you know, like how to communicate with people effectively and how to diffuse awkward situations. I might have just been because I've read Jono's stuff quite a bit and heard him talk quite a bit, so it all becomes quite familiar to me anyway.
That's fair enough. And I guess, yeah, there's probably a lot of crossover. It's all about making people kind of work together better.
Right? Yeah.
Which is very laudable. So check out Open Respect and get involved if you're interested. The Ubuntu One team have blogged. They are now using the Stack Exchange-based site, askubuntu.com, as an official support channel. So askubuntu.com is quite popular within Canonical, and some Ubuntu developers are moving to use it as well. So there's some question marks over what this might mean for Launchpad in the longer run.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there was a big debate, I think, wasn't there, in responses to this podcast about when you discussed the Stack Exchange model and people saying, no, please come back and use Launchpad because that's our official channel.
Yeah.
It's an interesting different perspective, isn't it?
That is, and it was it was initially an informal, unofficial Ubuntu help channel, and now it's the official Ubuntu help channel.
Well, no, it's the official Ubuntu One help channel.
Sorry, the official help channel.
Probably should make
Ubuntu
that distinction.
One. It's the same thing, isn't it? yeah, so the official help channel for Ubuntu One, but, you know, if it works for them, potentially, I guess you could see other things moving across to it, and then maybe things like Launchpad answers aren't quite as important, but that's entirely speculative. We don't know.
Yeah, we can only comment.
I genuinely don't know. Don't say things like that, because people think we have some incredible insider knowledge and we're just being snide and
oh, that's true.
And smarmy about. We just,
whereas we just genuinely have no idea.
We're just ignorant.
And in addition, the Ubuntu One team have announced a beta test of the file sync feature on Windows.
Yay! I think this is great.
I mean, no, definitely. It's a good thing in general. I just don't use Windows, so it doesn't affect me.
Well,
I haven't read the blog post actually, and I don't use Windows anymore. But I'd be curious to know whether there's any platform requirement or whether it's all versions of Windows.
We've got a little note here from Popey saying it requires .NET 4, which I assume means that it's written in C#,
and
could perhaps be ported to Mono. Who knows?
What you can't see at home is that Mark is shrugging and sort of.
Oh, sorry, Mark shrugs. Yeah. I should add that there.
Well, I think you can get .NET 4 on you know, Vista and XP. I'm fairly sure you can do so. So in theory, I guess it should run, but I'm just curious as to, I mean, it's looks like it's behind a beta registration link at the moment. And again, I'm not particularly interested, so I'm not going to go and register, but
it is a
I'm
closed
curious.
Beta at the moment, but it's interesting because when Ubuntu One started, they were very much, we're doing the Linux client. The protocols are open. If somebody wants to go and write a Windows client, they can go and do it. And that was the issue. We're doing the Linux version, not the Windows version. And now it's, and here, by the way, is a Windows version. La 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 la, here it is. I think it's a brilliant move because I guess the pressure from Dropbox, which works well on Linux, well on Windows, and...
Well on Mac.
Well on Mac. And
well on Android, and well on iPhone, and well on lots of things.
What are other things that nobody uses? and had a good pricing structure. Was obviously basically, I guess, maybe not doing Ubuntu One much good. Now Ubuntu One changed its pricing structure to match that of Dropbox. Now there's a Windows client coming out. You know, hopefully it'll be good to see, you know, an Android client or whatever coming out in future as well, maybe.
Well, I've had exactly this in that I've got a Windows XP machine at university. Probably wouldn't run on that anyway. But I got Dropbox just so I could share files between Ubuntu and Windows, and Ubuntu One just wasn't an option, even though that...
Yeah, even though there's a web interface.
Even though there's Dustin Kirkland has kicked off a lengthy discussion on the Ubuntu server and developer lists about making SSH an easily enabled option during a server install.
I agree.
What happens at the moment?
You install a base system, and then you have to do apt-get install OpenSSH server. Otherwise, you can't get remote access.
That's ridiculous. I hadn't noticed that, actually. And I'm sure I've installed... maybe I've just never been aware of it.
But basically, this is saying that in the install process, you should have a prompt that says, do you want to install SSH, and has yes highlighted, and all you have to do is hit enter. And
so the remote option otherwise is what? Telnet? Or
nothing.
Nothing.
Ubuntu server has a no... Ubuntu itself has a no ports open on a default install kind of rule, basically.
Right.
So no services running. But on the Ubuntu server install specifically, you can choose to install a LAMP server, DNS
you get sort
server.
Of like server package sets, if you will.
Yeah. Which would then give you those ports open, but you have explicitly co-opted into them.
Yeah, there's no option for a remote access server or something.
Which is just stupid, really. And you can install via SSH because you can. The installer itself can fire up an SSH session, which you can get into, but then you can't then connect to your server because it hasn't got OpenSSH installed.
Bruno Marg informs us that the monospace version of the new Ubuntu font is coming on the designcanonical.com blog.
Yeah.
I love the new Ubuntu font.
I really like it.
I've enabled it on everything. I've got the Chrome plugin that lets you replace all the fonts in Chrome with the Ubuntu font.
Oh, right.
It's great. Although, I'm looking at the monospace one, that there's a sample posted on the blog, and I'm thinking, looks like any other monospace font to me.
I do a lot of coding, so I use a lot of monospace fonts. So maybe if I see it all sort of in situ, I'll notice. But just looking at a sample in a sort of abstract environment, it's not really easy to tell what the difference is.
Yeah.
Alan Bell has kicked off a project to emulate the popular Flash-based online 3D Zoomy presentation platform Prezi using Ubuntu, Quickly, Python, and OpenGL.
Yes, and he has a Prezi presentation to launch you, it.
I don't like those presentations. Sorry, but I don't.
No, I'm not. Now, this means potentially it means we're just old fashioned and can't, and I can only have a kind of what's the word I'm looking for?
Linear
thought process.
When you're building a slide deck, you're building essentially a linear story.
Yeah.
And I think with Prezi, you have to think in slightly different terms. And it's quite exciting that it really does reinvent the way.
No, I do like the fact that somebody's looking at it differently, certainly. Yeah. But I just don't. when I'm watching a Prezi presentation, I just don't feel inspired to, you know.
No, I think it's got an initial wow factor, but I think after that it's actually, you know, one of the principles of presentation design is don't throw in every possible effect. I mean, that's a problem that lots of people have with when they first get their hands on PowerPoint. Oh my gosh, we can make all these things pop and sparkle, and they try and put every effect in. And actually, I think Prezi, although it has the one kind of twisting effect, that it can be a little bit distracting, I find, as a viewer. Actually, we've got a couple of people listening in our IRC channel this evening, and Andy SC is commenting that it makes you a bit seasick or carsick, and I think I kind of agree. I think some people actually have that problem with the 3D desktop effects as well, the wobbly windows or the desktop cube. I know that people complain. I've had people, colleagues at work, complain about, you know, if I've spun the desktop on a 3D cube, they go, oh, I can't cope with that. So I think sometimes you can have that problem with those kind of presentation effects.
But if you want to get involved in Alan's project, you can check that out. Launchpad.net/overview-project. We'll put a link in the show notes as well. And good luck, Alan. And don't take the comments we said about it, you know, being a bit annoying and making people sick too seriously. And that's all in the bit about Ubuntu this time. We're going to dive straight on in with your feedback. We had a lot this time around, a lot of long emails to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. It is helpful if you're sending us emails to try and keep them below, you know, the size of a thick hardback
book. Paragraph.
Yeah, a couple of paragraphs is really good. Thank you very much. We do really appreciate all of your comments. And a lot of the discussion was about the switching applications instead of, you know, filing bugs and getting the applications that don't work fixed. We couldn't read out all of the emails, but these ones represented most of the views. Hannon emailed us about dealing with bugs in applications on Ubuntu.
Generally, when I come across a misbehaving app, I do the following. 1. Googling about the problem, bug, to try and find if it's a real bug or if that's how the app should work. 2. I try and find the solution. 3. If I can't find a solution to the problem, I switch the app with a bad feeling because I want to stick as much as I can to the program that is shipped with the distro, because I think that the program has been tested with that distro and it should work better than the other. I don't want to switch to another program just to find another problem. 4. Try to report a bug if it is an easy thing to do.
How does that match with your perceptions of what you do if you find a bug in an application?
I skipped to number 3.
But do you try to find the solutions, though? Have a Google
Yeah, I mean, what I was saying to Anne last week is really I tend to go straight for the switch if I know there's another program which doesn't have the problem. So I would initially look for the solution if I didn't know there was that problem. Yeah.
I'd say I pretty much agree with those 4 steps. That's pretty much what I do.
Yeah.
And I must admit, you know, filing a bug is usually last on that list, unfortunately. But then
when did you last file a bug?
I can't actually remember, Toadu, but you know,
I filed one today, actually.
Wow. Is it fixed yet? James John Eaton emailed us about getting fixes to bugs that you do report.
I require a system that works. I kind of depend on having a computer system that does work. Many years ago, I used to use Debian testing. I know from experience what a pain it is to have apps stop working on you, especially when you have a deadline to meet. That is why I chose to stay with Ubuntu LTS. I choose to stay with Ubuntu LTS. I'm currently on 8.04. This way I know that the apps are going to work. My experience has been that reporting bugs will not get a fix. I've been trying to move to 10.04 LTS on a separate hard drive, but have experienced the showstopper to beat all showstoppers. The problem is that 10.04 will not boot from a power-up. I think you will agree that this is a major bug. I reported this bug in 3 places in Launchpad because I also found that it would happen with 10.10 and reported it in an old bug for 9.10. This was several weeks ago and no action has been taken. For a major bug like this, I expect some requests for information. I've replied to the request for extra information for the bug I opened against 10.10, but I have had no further news. And we've got a link to the Launchpad bug report in Grub 2 there.
Yeah, it's a bug against Grub 2. So, in all honesty, this it tallies with my experiences sometimes of filing bugs, is that I try to do my bestest bug report ever and give the information I think people want, but it never really seems to attract any attention. Now, maybe I'm using obscure, you know, packages or whatever, but in this case, you know, it's using Darks, the obscure revision control system that I use, against which I filed a bug a while ago. He's using, you know, Grub 2, so it's a fairly fundamental part of the operating system. James emailed us about how difficult it can be to report bugs.
I'm for switching if the issue is a pain. I find it difficult to report bugs. I once reported a bug about Bluetooth on Launchpad and the process was complicated. The different stages, such as triage and confirmation, were slow. I'll consider emailing the developers next time.
Yes. Well, emailing the developers direct is kind of a...
It's not
the done thing, is it? Unless they've got a specific bugs mailing list, then it's fair game, isn't it, really?
But it kind of suggests the frustration, doesn't it?
And often, if it's a bug stopping you doing something with your operating system, it's personal, really. It's, I can't do my work because of this bug on the system. Next up, Sorin, our regular correspondent Sorin, who writes us very long emails. He emailed to say, well, quite a lot, but here are some of the highlights.
Once upon a time, I was a happy KDE user and actually couldn't stand GNOME. So I started using Kubuntu. I used it for a couple of years, but I got fed up. It was ridiculous that sound and Wi-Fi worked on Ubuntu out of the box, but didn't on Kubuntu, so I decided to switch to Ubuntu. I know I wasn't accurate in my last email, but the thing is, Canonical is changing their ways. They used to be the company that gets open source and does Linux the Linux way. That's the sort of stuff that attracted a lot of attention and users at the same time. But now, Canonical is going to do Linux the Apple way. And that's not bad, as long as they don't pick up some of the nasty habits Apple have. It's actually really, really great. The way I see it, trying to look like a Mac is Ubuntu's best bet of becoming the leader in this new market of ARM PCs, and at the same time, the best way to convince vendors to pick up this new architecture. But I don't like it happening to the distro I use, and I can tell you guys aren't so sure about it either. If I had to install GNOME Shell for myself, that's a deal-breaker, because it's exactly the reason why I started using Ubuntu in the first place. Plus, it's normal when big changes like these happen for some people to leave. There's no point in being bitter or angry about it on either side, and especially not condescending. Calling it Shuttleworth's Law only gets people even more alienated. I know it's somewhat silly to have such strong feelings about your operating system that quite possibly nobody cares about, but such is the open source world. So my answer to the question would be, whenever you feel the project isn't moving the way you would want it to, it's normal to ditch the software. Up until that point, remember it's open source, so give it a chance. But this doesn't really count for completely new users. We've settled on something, but people are trying Linux for the first time haven't. So if they go and try something else, it doesn't really count as switching.
Do you think that's fair, that people should be able to just kind of shop around distros until they find one they like, and then they've emotionally bought into that distro?
Well, I tried quite a few before I settled with Ubuntu.
Okay, so and I guess nobody would have considered you treacherous or, you know, it's just shopping around, isn't it?
Yeah.
Trying to find one that you like, and then... when you settled on Ubuntu, it became something that you were kind of interested in and invested in because you spent time learning how it works and how the applications that it comes with works. And then when they change, it might feel a bit disorienting for you, you know, carpet getting pulled out from under your feet, I guess.
I suppose so, yeah. Remember, it's open source, so give it a chance. Does that mean we don't expect open source to be as good? Or
no, I think it's just my personal view, and I don't know whether this is exactly what Soren's saying, but... I think I like to give things a chance, right? So if something's different, it's new, it's not what I'm used to, maybe it's open source, I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
For a while. I'm not saying I'm not expecting it to be as good or stable or whatever. I'm just prepared to give something that's different a go.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. And finally, Peter Cannon points out that maybe Ubuntu's strengths are also its weaknesses when it comes to getting people to persist and report bugs.
The problem is freedom. Choice and little to no cash outlay. Taking Gwibber as the example talked about. A. The ability to use whatever you want for a lot of people means a low loyalty level. B. Given the large amount of not too dissimilar applications available, it's easy just to dump Gwibber and use another. C. Seeing as you don't have to buy Gwibber and you don't have to buy the replacement you intend to use, there's no sense of out of pocket. Of course, there is another blame factor as well. Ease of install. As I was reminded the other day, Pete, remember the old days when you spent hours trying to configure X? And to be honest, that's a good point.
And he means X, the graphical environment.
Yes, as opposed to insert piece of software here.
Yeah, okay.
Back then, most of us wouldn't dream of wiping out our beloved install that had taken us 6 months to get right. We would have filed bugs, asked on mailing lists or IRC, and once every avenue was exhausted, then probably uninstall Gwibber and install something else, but rarely wipe and install another distro. Nowadays, pretty much every distribution works out of the box. In most cases, you can have something up and running in 15 to 20 minutes, as opposed to an hour or so like we had a few years ago. So I suspect most people do go, oh, stuff this, I'll stick Fedora on. Is that progress or is it sad? The Throwaway Society joins the open source community.
Ooh, that's very deep, Peter.
Isn't it?
Yeah, Peter's a regular in our IRC channel, @ubuntu-uk-podcast on the Freenode IRC network. He usually pops in there in the afternoon and says hello to everybody. I guess it is. It's less commitment for people who perhaps... I mean, he's absolutely right. I mean, I spent ages trying to get X running on an old Debian system, 4, 5, 6, mind you, more years ago than I care to remember. And yeah, it would have taken a lot for me to have to move away from it at that point.
Yeah.
I was quite proud of myself this month in that I had a problem which would have normally prompted me to reinstall, hoping that it would fix it, and I actually found out what the problem was and fixed it myself.
Wow, that's almost hardcore.
I know.
I must admit, I've never, I can remember, reinstalled Ubuntu to fix a problem with the operating system. Occasionally, I've cleaned the home area out, or got rid of all the .dot files.
I've done that more than I've reinstalled Ubuntu completely, but I have... Yeah. Reinstalled Ubuntu, especially after an upgrade, but that's a bit of a different scenario.
Maybe we're just better at making sure that we don't, you know, muck up our our systems at a fundamental level, only at a user level. Cool. Okay.
Victor Jones emailed us with an idea to make bug reporting easier.
I was really impressed to hear that GWIPR allows quick bug reporting from the help. It seems to me that GNOME could specify a standard that all GNOME apps should have that button in the app's help screen that would help take the user to the bug reporting site for the project, with many of the reporting fields pre-filled. Okay, so that's going to take some time to happen, even if everyone agreed to do it tomorrow, but Canonical seems to be ideally placed to actually implement this right now. After all, they tweak the base distro and have a bug reporting system. I imagine it wouldn't take too much effort to add a button into the help function for each app. The file bug/feature request link could take the user to a launchpad page for that app. If or when at some point the app has its own bug reporting page, then the link could be redirected there.
I believe that KDE apps do a similar sort of thing in the help menu. I think most of the ones which are actually part of the KDE project have a report a bug.
Well, I'm just navigating around my Ubuntu desktop at the moment, and they all have help report a problem on the menu.
Ah, there we go then.
So certainly all the core Ubuntu apps actually have that.
Now they're responsive.
Exactly. So, you know, we've already addressed that particular issue, which is all very good.
Michael White left a comment on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, about LTS releases.
It seems to me that the latest LTS of Ubuntu should always be the public face of the Ubuntu distribution. However, now that 10.10 is out, it seems to be all but forgotten, with every tutorial, blog entry and articles regarding 10.04 abruptly ending on... 10th of September or thereabouts. So I personally consider the distros between LTS releases to be feature development releases, not ready for the normal needs of production-centered users. It's very disheartening as a user who likes to get comfortable with his OS for a bit. I don't start using a new distro until it's been out for at least 2 months before installing it, so that the majority of significant bug fixes can find their way into the updates. The Ubuntu release model just seems to be a programmer developer-centric way of doing things and not an end-user-friendly way. Why can't the main website feature the LTS on the splash screen with a button somewhere saying, help develop Ubuntu, get on the cutting edge here, or something similar to that? As an end user, primarily concerned with being productive on my PC, I find this constant change a bit fatiguing. Indeed, it leaves me with a feeling that my current OS has just been discarded, since the new packages for applications, Firefox, LibreOffice, the latest software center, only seem to be developed for the latest and not for the long term. Repeat, long term support edition.
I think that's an interesting point of view as well, because I am one of those who complains when, for example, Spotify isn't working on Maverick, because I want it to be working on Maverick because I paid for Spotify and I want to be running on the bleeding edge, but I'm on the bleeding edge.
Yeah.
You know, I need to be cognizant of the fact that I'm not using an LTS here.
Mm. But they are starting to address that now, aren't they, by having, I can't remember what they call it now, but having it so that they are sort of pushing updates for older releases through the software center, I seem to remember.
Okay. Maybe.
Yes, that sounds familiar.
There was a name for it which I saw this week, but I can't remember what it was.
It's kind of a catch-22, really. If you use a long-term support edition, you can't then complain that there isn't new stuff appearing in that long-term support edition.
That would make it unstable, potentially.
Yeah, and you make your choice. Either you go with the long-term support edition, there's stuff there, you've got desktop for 3 years, server for 5 years, and you stick with those versions that are there. Security updates and everything is fine. Or you go with the funky development version to get all the new goodness and accept that, it is a development release and some stuff might not work.
It's like the older, well, back in the days when I used to run Debian, whether you ran Debian stable or Debian testing, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Ross left us a comment on the website after hearing about the Juggler alarm clock.
I ran various netbook remixes on my Juggler, but in the end, I didn't think it was a good fit. Although it ran fine, it's too hard to use, it's too small. I tried Android, which was hard work to get up and running, and when I did, it wouldn't find the Wi-Fi. Shame, as I think Android would be much better.
I think I've got a Juggler as well, and I'm running, I think, the one that, yeah, that was talked about a few weeks ago with the same standard distribution, but upgraded underneath to Maverick, I think we were talking about, weren't we?
Yeah.
And I think Android on that device is going to be tricky. I agree that it's possibly quite a nice idea, but you've just got to look at the number of really bad tablets that are coming out with Android on at the moment.
I saw review on Ars Technica.
I think we saw the same
$99 tablet.
Yeah, there was a really bad review of an Android tablet today. And an Android has to be really heavily tweaked to the hardware it's running on. That's one of the challenges that operating system has. With the phones, you know, it's quite a leap each time that a new version of Android comes out to get the hardware fully supported. Even the one I've just upgraded to 2.2 has got some location issues. So, I'm not surprised that particular device has got some problems with Android.
I did try it when I first got the Juggler. There was an image of Android that you could just stick on a USB stick. And while it's nice because it's designed for touchscreens, whereas Ubuntu at the time wasn't really thinking about touchscreens, the graphics were really, really, really slow. So, you know, you'd drag and you'd have to wait a minute for anything to happen. So certainly it's if you're going to be looking at putting an Android on it, there's work and tweaking, as you say, to be done.
Yeah. I saw Ubuntu running on Alan's Juggler the other weekend, and that was quite impressive. Perhaps just slightly more impressive than the native thing, the native store stuff. But, you know, it was good. It was good to see it used anyway. Yeah. I think that's the end of your feedback.
You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it.
Yeah, thanks for coming along, Andy. Have you enjoyed yourself?
I have, very much. Thank you very much for inviting me.
That's a pleasure. And thank you to everybody for listening for what I suspect might be a slightly overlong show. We might be able to do something in the edit. And thank you to the people in the IRC channel who've been enjoying our secret test stream. So if you hang out in the IRC channel a bit more, you can find out maybe some extra secret information. But yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode in this elongated season of the Ubuntu UK podcast. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.